the number of times that a bona fide world-class collector will come on holiday to South Africa and go, I had no idea. I had no idea that you had such a buoyant industry. I had no idea it was so professional. I had no idea it was so world-class. And we're like, yes, actually we are. Our artists continue to be invited to join galleries internationally, huge galleries. It continued to impress world-class collections, continued to accelerate their growth. And so there is a buoyancy and potential here in South Africa.
Welcome to the Latitudes Podcast, the voice of art from Africa. I'm your host, Refilwe Mpakanyane. Powered by i2 Art Ensure, Season 2 dives deep into the African art world across 12 curated episodes. Structured around four interconnected themes, we bring you insights from artists, curators, critics, and collectors. Join us as they reveal industry inner workings, creative journeys, market dynamics, criticism, and the evolving role of patrons. i2 Art Ensure offers peace of mind for passionate collectors. Do you own a growing art collection, or maybe just one special piece that means the world to you? Either way, i2 Art Ensure has your back. We know art and we know insurance, which means we understand exactly how to protect what matters to you, from irreplaceable heirlooms to your latest investment. Whether it's hanging on your wall, in storage, or on its way to a fair, we'll make sure it's covered. Visit i2.co.za or chat to your broker to find out more. i2 Art Ensure is an authorized financial services provider. My guest on this episode is South African-born gallerist Emma Fanamerva. Emma grew up in Switzerland and France and studied her bachelor's and master's in fine art at the Slade School of Fine Art in London before completing a master's in art management at City University, also in London. Emma was part of London's art scene for more than a decade, and during that time, she was appointed as assistant curator and registrar of the Cranford Collection with Andrew Renton. In 2011, she joined the Smack Art Gallery as its curator when its Cape Town doors were opened. Her next notable move was in July of 2014, when Emma joined Everard Reed Gallery in Cape Town as the head curator, and of course, she later became a director of the gallery. Emma's trajectory is rich with fantastic instances of being mentored by industry greats, starting out at vaunted international institutions, as well as soaking up the inner workings at blue chip galleries. In this conversation, Emma lays out her interests, obligations, and priorities as a gallerist who is heavily reliant on building relationships and networks, be this with other galleries, with her artists, or indeed her buyers. Emma is super passionate about the value of friendship and collaboration. Let's get into it. Emma Fanamerva, thank you so much for your time this morning. Welcome to the Latitudes Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's always very useful in these kind of conversations to start at the very beginning, your education background, which is firmly rooted in the arts. But give me a sense how, from a personal perspective, and perhaps even going as far back as childhood, your love affair with the art world, when did that begin? And of course, what then inspired you to become a gallerist?
I think I always had a kind of inclination to engage with the world materially. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that some children grow up very much in their heads or very much engaged with other children. And I was always usually playing on my own, usually outdoors, usually building, constructing, imagining. And then as time went on and I was studying at school, I always spent a lot of time in the art studio. At the time, that was probably because it was the only space that you could listen to music. And then, as toward the end of my sort of study period, doing the baccalaureate, which is 2 years, it's like the matric. In between those 2 years, I went to London and decided to actually do the summer school at the Slade School of Fine Art. And I realized that despite it not really being a kind of formal career trajectory, that I could imagine myself viewing the world through that lens. Our parents were both academics and both sort of business school academics, and they'd always instilled in us a very strong work ethic, but they said it doesn't matter what you do as long as it's what you want to do and it's at the best place in the world and it's not what we do. So I became a student of fine art and my sister became a student of creative writing. And yeah, that was my entry into that industry, was to study. And I was very fortunate. It was the late 90s and there were many exceptional artists still in academia. And I was very fortunate to have the privilege to do my undergraduate and my postgraduate also to a certain degree under the mentorship of Phyllida de Barlow, who subsequently after her retirement went on to become a seminal sculptress in the world and was recognized properly before her untimely passing.
Can you tell me what kind of aperture that opened up for you in terms of what is possible and most importantly, what you could create? Because already it sounds as though your parents were not at all naive about the fact that you can be in the creative arts, but paired with a kind of sensibility that allows you to then be able to hold your own.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, to have been lectured and been in the presence of such important artists. What kind of aperture does that give you into the arts world or open up for you?
It's interesting, and I'm sure we will come full circle to this, but obviously the arts industry, depending on where you position yourself globally, what I mean by that is if you're working and living in London and working and living in New York, it's a very different arts industry than working in the southern continent of Africa. Immediately one understood with quite a bit of sobriety that if you wanted to be a successful full-time artist, and what I mean by that is make a career in the industry, support yourself, make a contribution, a proper contribution, you had to surround yourself in an environment where you had access to the best opportunities. And the easiest mm-hmm. way to begin that journey was to insert yourself into a very good art college. And in the late 90s, that was Goldsmiths, Slade, St. Martin's, and then when you went on to study your master's, the Royal College and the Royal Academy. And a lot of the kind of important heads of that industry, you know, a lot of the very important artists spent some time contributing back to the sort of the study community. So we had access at the Slade to many visiting artists, Annette Messenger, Sonia Bryce. We had weekly lectures, visiting lecturers, Sam Taylor Wood, Jenny Saville, Gavin Turk.
Yeah.
And these were individuals who in the global sphere were incredibly huge. And subsequently, especially in the case of Annette Messenger and Sonia Bryce, have gone on to even more stellar sort of acknowledgement in terms of their careers. You know, we had access to these people in our infancy as developing our professional practice. And it was just the idea that one could insert oneself into that kind of environment early on whilst cultivating your languages. And when you had tutorials, when you had visiting artists observing your work and critiquing it, that it really was coming from a very high standard, which immediately already placed you in a different league.
That's just absolutely fascinating. It sounds beautiful, actually.
It was very hard work, and I don't presume to know every single art school, but most definitely the tutors were very demanding, and the caliber of what you were expected to produce was very high. Once you managed to insert yourself in there, you had to survive and you had to flourish. And it was very much each person was in charge of their own trajectory. There was no hand-holding. Yeah. And I think that was also like, it is the case in the creative industry. There's lots of artists, but to be a successful artist requires such a degree of willpower, timing, momentum, understanding of one's practice. It's not for everyone.
I like the fact that you brought up something that I was going to touch on very shortly, but why not talk about it now? The fact that there is no hand-holding and the fact that in our industry or in the creative arts, but in visual arts, there is no blueprint. There literally is no pathway to success as one might find with being a CA. You write your exams, you then enter an organization at a junior level, you might be seconded to London for a couple of years, and then thereafter, you're aiming for director. And then thereafter, you're aiming for the next thing. There is no such thing in terms of a ladder or a structure in the arts industry. So could you give me a sense, as a gallerist, how do you describe your journey so far? and what has brought you this far?
I think my journey has been an incredibly privileged one. I had access at a very early point to insert myself into incredible opportunities and institutions, just studying at the Slade under, surrounded by the artists that I've mentioned before, but also then engaging with Andrew Renton, who at present is head of Goldsmith's Art Theory, but at the time was actually head of Slade sort of Art Theory. And immediately I was up on my stepladder inserting my MA degree show, and he kind of pulled on my trousers and said, "Do you want a part-time job? I'm working with a very established private collection. The Cranford Collection is one of the most important sort of private collections open to the public in London." And at the time, I had these opportunities present themselves to me where I was inserted into a very kind of high level from a very early start. So Andrew and myself worked with the Muriel and Freddie Salem to build the collection, and the young artists all the way through to Damien Hirst, Rebecca Warren, Anthony Gormley. And so I had access through Andrew and through that experience to engaging with many of the blue chip galleries in London and in Europe, and seeing it from that perspective. And then subsequent to that, when I joined MoMOT, which was the most sort of robust art shipping agent at the time, my gallerist team, so gallery team, were individuals earmarked for specific blue chip galleries. And we worked exclusively with Damien Hirst and Rachel Wright Reed and White Cube and Gagosian. And it's very easy to run off these names like they mean nothing, but it gave me a huge insight into sort of the top sort of level of effective performance and delivery and that industry and the kind of the sobriety of it being at that level. It was the reality and the robustness of the industry that was coming across. It was the kind of the top end of the business side of it, but also in just in terms of the placement and the demand. But it was exciting.
No doubt, very exciting. Talk to me then, having experienced the gallery ecosystem from that top level that you've just mentioned, and once again, you're here in South Africa and experiencing it and helming it at a top level yourself. I'm wondering what it feels like for you to be in that nexus where what you're doing is trying to optimize the reputation and the standing of Everard Reed Cape Town, the gallery, but at the same time, you're trying to optimize the sort of investment value that the buyer is also coming to you for, while at the same time managing the interests of your artists that you represent as well. What does that tension look like? And are there things, or what are the things rather, from your London experience that you've brought to bay now at Everard Reed that have stood you in just really good stead?
I can only obviously speak from my own perspective of being in London, but the reality of working at that level in London and in those spaces was that the kind of inherent passion and enthusiasm for the practice of art and the artist was very much in the background. And when I came back on holiday to South Africa, I realized that the art scene was incredibly buoyant and incredibly dynamic and world class. And I thought to myself, this is exciting. This is why I want to be in this industry. And it's that kind of like genuine hand on the heart, dedication, enthusiasm, dare I say, love for the industry that you see in many gallerists that I wanted to celebrate and enjoy. So I came back to this country and it wasn't very hard to insert myself back into the industry here. The question about the more people that come from the collector bases around the world, and I speak from a Cape Townian perspective, the number of times that a bona fide world-class collector will come on holiday to South Africa and go, "I had no idea. I had no idea that you had such a buoyant industry. I had no idea it was so professional. I had no idea it was so world-class." And we're like, yes, actually we are. Our artists continue to be invited to join galleries internationally, huge galleries. It continued to impress world-class collections, continued to accelerate their growth. And so there is a buoyancy and potential here in South Africa for the local talent if they are steadfast in their practice, if it is pertinent, if it is professional, if it ties into so many unpredictable variables to impact beyond the African continent. And if a collector, be they an established international collector or a young one, work with a curator, work with an advisor, work with galleries that they connect with, because we are all very different, with ethoses yes. that resonate with them, that develop friendships. And I say friendships because it is a friendship to work with a collector. It is a lifetime journey with a collector. It's a lifetime journey with an artist. If they develop a rapport, a connection with a small, intricate group of art galleries, then invariably they will trust them, and invariably the advice and connection that they will receive will pay dividends. And when I say pay dividends, we always say invest in something that you love. Invariably, if you're working with a professional gallery, the price point, for want of a better word, will grow of the value of the work.
Yeah.
But it's not about investment with a capital I. It's about an investment in your soul. It's about an investment in your love and passion of collecting, even if it's your first work to a huge collection. And invariably, if you make connections with galleries that resonate with you in terms of their stable, in terms of their sort of gallery programming and their ethos, then those two go hand in hand.
After the break, we continue our conversation. Looking to discover and collect art from Africa's most exciting talent? Latitudes Online is the world's leading market for art from Africa, connecting you to over 2,000 artists across the continent. Browse curated collections, read thought-provoking editorial, and shop with confidence, knowing your artwork will be delivered safely and securely. Head to latitudes.online to explore the future of African art, and don't forget to sign up for our newsletter.
I like what you talk about when you talk about this relationship fundamentally as a friendship, because you have to be simpatico on so many levels that it clearly can't purely be a business transaction. But talk to me about retaining talent as a talent grows and evolves and explores in that artistic practice. I spoke to Mark Reed for Latitudes in 2023, and he basically said what you're saying now, very clear about the fact that his own approach always emphasizes the artist's happiness and the galleries as well. But ultimately, if a person needs to move on, or if they need or want something that you are not in a position to give them, don't hold them back or impede them. Talk to me about the ways in which you nurture, interact with, and keep track of your artists, i.e. just keeping your finger on the pulse of their life, their developments, their aspirations, in a way that perhaps goes beyond studio visits, which are, of course, fundamental as well to your job.
I think first and foremost, it is always very important, and this is why I'm grateful for the 6 years of university study as a fine artist myself, is to understand that an artist and their artwork are the same thing. And what I mean by that is that obviously there is such a thing as a professional artist who makes their career in this industry, who makes their income in this industry. But one cannot separate the artist and their work. It is an extension of who they are. It is an extension of their soul. It is an extension of their pain. It is an extension of their DNA. And when you understand that as a gallerist, then you understand that your investment isn't just about studios. It isn't just about ticking boxes. That inherently you are embarking on a lifetime journey with somebody. And that lifetime could last for 2 years, or it could, and I don't know if Mark mentioned this, in the case of his relationship with Mahabo Sabidi, it has been a relationship since the 1970s. And so often artists will start at an entry level at our gallery. For example, they've just graduated from Michaelis, or they've just started a full-time sort of practice as an artist. And you begin this journey, this relationship, with the ambitions of understanding the DNA of how the artist works. Now, that means that you are available to them. It means that you talk to them about their work, but also you understand aspects of their lives. It's not to say that every artist is the same. Some artists are very sort of boundaries about what they're prepared to engage with, and some artists, their work is who they are, and so you have to understand how they are living and breathing and existing at this moment in time in their lives in order to understand where their practice is. It is a very intense thing, a relationship between a gallerist and an artist, if done correctly, in order to open up and maximize yourself and the potential of the work in order to garner the most successful, robust vision of what the artist is trying to achieve and to be there present helping them achieve it. You have to understand the building blocks of what's getting you there, and you have to be present the whole time.
So it's the business of art. It is the social side of it. It is the psychologist part of it. It is the counselor career guidance part of it. You're doing everything.
You are exactly right. It is about understanding the complexity and mixture of the recipe that it takes to make up an artist. And sometimes the gallery and the artists will drift, like any kind of intense one-on-one relationship. And if you are serving your artist, if you are doing everything that you set out to do, if the work is achieving what it needs to achieve, then invariably it will attract the attention of other galleries. Invariably it will attract the attention of other gallerists. And it's about meeting the expectations and exceeding them. And that said, we do have artists within the gallery fold who we, for want of a better word, share with other galleries. And that's a very successful kind of polyamorous relationship.
Yeah, so not everything has to be exclusive in that regard. Just let's stay on that. I was just reading about Valerie Beston, the gallery director of the Marlborough, who took care of Bacon for many years. And the extent to which she was involved with his life and his career, to the point where she was countersigning checks, helping him pay his bills at Harrods, making sure his rent was paid on time. Just really, really intense. Once you've read a little bit about that, you do get then a real appreciation for the fact that, like you said, this is soul work. This is about love. And you are giving a lot to this journey and to this career. But let's talk about a facet that you mentioned earlier on, which is that exclusivity. What might a typical, no, let's not say typical, what might a good contract with your gallery look like as an artist? Is it purely a consignment contract? What aspects are you delving into putting down on paper so that both parties are always aware of what, or always know what to expect of each other, and there's no gray area? What does a good contract look like for you in your eyes?
So I think that a contract, in inverted commas, is about the idea of transparency. So we don't have any written contracts with our artists. And we don't do that because we believe if we're doing our job properly, we don't need it. Now, that is based on trust and transparency. So a good contract is a circumstance where there is a mutual understanding, a mutual, depending on the depth of the relationship, if it's an exclusive relationship. So what that would mean theoretically would be that some of our senior artists would qualify that as all of the inquiries, all of the efforts, all of the requests, all of the administration, anything to do with their practice other than their making gets deviated to the gallery, and the gallery deals with everything. And the gallery, therefore, is the entity where if you are interested in acquiring a work by that artist in South Africa or in the UK, then you would go specifically to this gallery. And all of the artist's strongest works are sent through that gallery space. Exclusivity post-COVID is very different, or contracts are very different post-COVID. So pre-COVID, the chances of an artist collaborating with multiple galleries was less viable. The idea of an artist working actively with the gallery but not being in their stable was frowned upon. But I think COVID and post-COVID gave the industry, at least here in South Africa, permission to expand upon the definitions of what it meant. If you have an artist under your umbrella and they're in your stable, and you are, for want of a better word, working with them exclusively, essentially what you are saying is, we believe, as this gallery, that every single work that you make, if it's good enough, we can place in a collection, an institution or a private collection or a public collection. But sometimes the notion of exclusivity can be expanded upon. So we have artists that we work with who aren't necessarily only showing with us, but we expect, based on the kind of gallery that we are, that when we do work with them, their best work comes to us. But if they choose to engage with other institutions or other galleries, depending on that situation and depending on the location, that's okay.
Flesh that out for me, Emma, and just tease that out for me a little bit. What COVID did specifically that upended people's expectations or conventions? What was it about COVID, aside from the real and harsh reality of businesses just not being able to stay afloat?
I think that what COVID did, especially for our kind of conglomerate of galleries, is it made us realize that there is a very fine line between being a full-time practicing artist, and in some cases a full-time practicing artist with a group of individuals that you are responsible for, like a studio or a foundry. Mm-hmm. It's a very fine line between being a full-time practicing artist producing work, the work selling, gallery paying you, and you sustaining this ecosystem, and everything shutting down to the point of no movement. And then within a matter of a few months, in some cases even a month, everything going into the red. And what COVID did was it became very clear very quickly how vulnerable and how responsible everyone was. And how if your gallery didn't show up for you and didn't sell your work and didn't professionally with transparency engage with you in terms of payments and information and feedback, how quickly things could go very bad. So what COVID did demonstrate was that as much as it was exciting for many galleries to go internationally to art fairs, as exciting as it was to kind of place things in institutions around the world, if you're incapable of reaching those spaces, if you're incapable of getting on those planes, if everything's shut down, really at the end of the day, you need to have an infrastructure in place or a gallery in place that can sell your work, pay you so that you can keep all of these families that you are responsible for or your own family going. So it was quite a sort of revelation for a lot of people. And I think also for a lot of galleries, because all of a sudden everyone looked around and said, oh my goodness, we have X number of artists that we're responsible for. Maybe we don't need to lock them in to be exclusive with us. Maybe we can't guarantee that we can be responsible for taking care of them during these times. And I think that's what I meant when I said that in some instances, artists were given permission by their galleries to work collaboratively. We increasingly find ourselves collaborating with other galleries and collaborating with artists that are officially listed under other galleries. And the relationship is much more fluid and organic than it was pre-COVID.
Does it feel as though many fellow gallerists and galleries have embraced this new status quo, this new gallery model? Or is it something that's still settling and everyone's defining it for themselves? But how does it feel for you from an Everard Reed perspective?
I mean, I think that the attitude that we have at this gallery is that with the best intentions at heart, our artists, in some instances, on a daily basis, our artists are invited to partake in things, invited to engage with things. And we will always acknowledge and review any request or any opportunity and then feedback to our artist after that. So every gallery is different. And certainly in some instances, we're like, that sounds great for a certain artist. But in other instances, we're like, actually, that doesn't serve the artist, or we're not prepared to relinquish work for whatever reason. Not because we're holding on to something and we don't want to share the artist per se, but because perhaps that exclusivity is very important to us. I think across the board, you know, that a lot of the galleries have understood that the ecosystem needs to thrive, especially in these unpredictable times. I know that Joburg collaborated with Stevenson on a Robin Road exhibition at Circa. I know that there's many artists that we have combined here as well to work with the gallery in group exhibitions. And I know that there are a few artists that we work with, that other galleries work with, and feels much more fluid in its kind of percolation within the industry.
I was taking a look at the latest UBS Art Basel report, and just one of the things that stood out for me was that first-time buyers are up by about 38%, and those sales have grown in the lower and mid-market tiers. Is this an international trend that is also reflected in the South African and African art context? And it sounds like it ought to be good news. Am I right to feel that way or assume so?
I think it is. Certainly, a lot of international collectors come into South Africa because the work is so good and because, dare I say it, the value for money is very good. With the exchange rate, you can actually acquire exceptional examples by artists if they're available for reasonably decent prices. And then in some instances, subsequently, artists then go on to be picked up by international galleries. And I know a lot of international collectors enjoy that buzz of finding up-and-coming artists, younger artists, for want of a description.
You know, getting in on the ground floor, yes,
and
sure.
Also the idea, and I think that this is also something that's very beautiful about our industry, especially here in Southern Africa, is kind of cultivation of the grassroots level of artists and the kind of contribution that so many are making, including Latitudes, where you're inserting younger artists into an opportunity to have access to a wider spectrum of collectors and enthusiasts. Yeah. Are more first-time buyers arriving? I suppose so. I think it's financially, globally, it's very, we don't need to say it's incredibly crazy out there at the moment. So the notion of buying artwork, it's not a necessity. But people are enjoying the idea, especially here in Africa, where the price point is relatively reasonable for an original artwork comparative to other places. So first-time buyers are coming, and they are investing in the more cost-effective and entry-level prices, whatever those may be. And there are lots of opportunities on the ground here too, not just in galleries for people to have access to work. Lots of pop-ups and lots of sort of fringe events, which give people access, perhaps, that it's less, those kinds of things are less encouraged in Europe or the States.
Mm-hmm. In terms of trends, your go-to, I guess, literature sources when it comes to understanding what's going on in the art world at large, but also here at home, could you name two or three sort of resources that you rely on in your professional life?
Resources being kind of publications or...
Publications, yes, exactly.
I think it always serves one to have a look at what respected or fresh or young or interesting curators are doing, because I think often the curators themselves are setting the language out. So rather than actual publications, of course one looks to Art Forum and one listens to a lot of podcasts, the art newspaper. These are all like global sort of referential summaries, which are useful. But observing what curators that one respects and admires, what they are doing, how they are making the connections in the work that they are planning, in the group shows that they are planning, that's always very exciting. I am also a fan of Arthrop, of course. And I mean, there's so many podcasts out there now. There's so many opportunities to listen to individuals feeding back globally, but you have access to it here now.
I'm mentioning these trends, I guess, on the business side of things, on the buying side of things. But are there any specific trends that you feel as though Southern African artists themselves are exploring, or do we tend to have an abiding sort of theme or focus in our work? And that's broad, and I'm talking about contemporary artists.
Certainly, the last Venice Biennale was a very kind of insight into sort of the language that we as individuals on the African continent have come to know very well. And it was exciting to see some of our artists there, to see some of our historical artists there, to see that Sokoto as well. And the kind of curation that was more based on a language of craft and textile and materiality and returning back to the kind of form of mark making and craft making rather than anything that sort of had lost the human touch. But that's something that we continue to do. I'm always very nervous about the word trend because the art ecosystem exists like any solar system. The planets navigate round and get close to certain things, and then the swirling of the trend planets will come full circle over and over again. So is there any immediate trend? I'm more preoccupied with cultivating the best forms of what the artists that I'm involved with are cultivating, rather than steering things or observing things or trying to tick boxes. I believe that we are very interested in finding exceptional artists who are authentic to their craft and making, be it quieter contributions in some instances when they're younger, or in this case of Sabidi, huge contributions. But I don't think we're looking around for trends or trying to nail them down.
After the break, we continue our conversation. Are you passionate about the power of the arts to drive change and build meaningful connections? Business and Arts South Africa, BASA, is here to bridge the gap between business and the arts. Whether you're a business looking to invest in the creative sector or an artist seeking to grow your impact, BASA membership connects you to the people, programs, and partnerships that matter. Visit basa.co.za for more info and be part of bridging the gap.
Which artist is inspiring you at the moment?
Which of the artists are inspiring me at the moment? Gosh, that's a really loaded question. I've been involved with Brett Charles Seeler since his Ruth Prowse days. And it's exciting and dynamic and so impressive to watch somebody with such a strong work ethic continually raising the expectations and bar of what he's capable of. We had the most exceptional show with him at the start of this year.
The Investec Art Fair, right?
Yes, so it was during the Investec Art Fair, and he has relocated now to Leipzig. We work very closely with his gallery, Eigen Plus Art, there. And the expectations placed upon Brett are astronomical, and his ability to continue to work professionally but authentically to his voice and to challenge his materiality and to continue to paint such robust examples of his language, it just continues to impress me. This year alone, he has a review at a German museum, and he has an exhibition in South Korea, and he's produced a show for us as well. So that's an example of an artist who is shining so brightly, and it's an absolute pleasure to be in the presence of that kind of sort of talent.
Emma, how do you handle those difficult conversations? You've just used Brett as an example of an artist that has inspired you, but how do you have those difficult conversations with your artists or with an artist who maybe they've been caught in the trap of creating something that has worked and they're fearful about exploring and moving from what they know? Or perhaps the work ethic is just not up to scratch and perhaps their own standards, never mind anybody else's standards. How do you prepare for them and how do you go about them?
Well, you're giving me nice, juicy questions today. It's lovely. I think that kind of falls back onto the integrity of the relationship. And if I'm doing my job properly, then the foundation of the relationship with the artist, and again, it's not a kind of generic overall rule of thumb for everyone, but if you are engaging with somebody with sincerity and authenticity, and you are with their best interests at heart, acting as a vessel and conduit for a manifestation of what should be the best version of what they're trying to achieve, then the relationship is based on an honest, integrous, transparent sharing of information. And there are some instances where an artist is in a funk or they're not feeling it. And that's why we come full circle. This is not, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's an extension of who they are living and breathing. And any kind of variable in an artist's life affects their production and their ability to be creative. As creatures, you know, their DNA is instilled in their work. And so we have many artists that have moments of absolute glory and then sadness after a show is launched, or moments of kind of confusion about where their practice is heading, or moments of thinking that something is really a great idea and you're kind of like, yeah. But if the sincerity is there and if the trust is there, then one should be able to be honest and gentle, or better still, give the artist space and time to process what it is they are processing. Support them as best you can, but protect them from allowing things to leave the studio if they're not ready to leave.
That reminds me, I've got a good friend who, when she calls you or pulls you aside and says, "Listen, my friend," she never says that any other time. She's about to give you some insights into what she's observed about
so
you
funny.
At that point. And you're like, okay, give it to me. What, to your mind, Emma, is a non-negotiable for an artist to have a handle on when it comes to the business of the art world? So yes, you've got your gallery and they're amazing. You've got this fantastic relationship and they are looking out for your best interests. But what are the basics that, to your mind, an artist needs to do their best to just have a handle on for themselves?
it depends on the variables. But first of all, like the artist's price point is critical. And without going down a rabbit hole too far, what I mean by that is that if an artist is engaged in a full-time relationship with the gallery, where there's conversations about their price point and it's consistent, and the gallery acts as the only kind of source of the artist's work, and so they can control that price point, that's important. And that's fine.
Okay.
But if an artist exists in a kind of more blurred line relationship with various galleries or isn't represented by a gallery, then the most important thing is that their price point is consistent. And what I mean by that is that then the artist, within reason and with and being realistic, sets a certain set of contexts and prices for their work. And that doesn't deviate, because the worst case scenario is an artist is selling their work for X in one place, and then they speak to somebody else and that person says, that's not enough and we have to add on more. That's too expensive. We have to do. And then the collectors are looking around, because nowadays with the internet and with Google and with ArtNet, it is very easy to find historical price points. If you're messing with your price point and that's not consistent and you're not setting a standard of what it should be, regardless of the circumstance locally, then that's critical. What's also critical is obviously to present yourself and your practice and your work in a capacity that you would wish to be acknowledged. And what I mean by that is that your photographs are good, your work is well labeled, you're on time, you're transparent about things. And so it makes the relationship with the gallery effortless and more fluid, and it allows the gallery or whomever is working with your work to do their job. Those kinds of raise the bar to the standard that in which you wish to be treated as an artist, and demonstrate that in your own professional capacity.
That's a lovely bit of advice. So buyers, of course, connect everything together in this ecosystem. How do you tend to see the gallerist-gallery relationship to the buyer, and how do you nurture it?
It's a bit like being an artist in this industry. So people buy art as an enjoyment, as a love, as an obsession, as a dedication, as a passion. So it isn't something that they do in their workday necessarily in a situation where it's just another tick in a box. It's done with exuberance and enthusiasm. It's done over a glass of wine at the end of the day. It's done on the weekend. It's done when they're chatting to their friends and they're looking through their phone. So one has to understand that the collector, be they a fledgling collector who's just starting or a international collector who has worked from all kinds of galleries from around the world, it's a passion. And as a gallerist, you understand that the collector animal sees it as something that's an extension of them as well. How do I cultivate the relationships? It's a bit like the relationship with the artist. I have collectors that buy from me once and I never hear from them again. And then I have collectors, my best collector bought something from me in SMAC in 2011 and bought something from me last week and everything in between. And that's been a lifetime journey together. That's been the better part of 16 years. And the more you understand the collector, the more you engage with their ideas and their passions and their thoughts and their concerns, honestly, then you grow a relationship, a very intense relationship, and you start to make connections with them. It is. It's a very close friendship. And it's not just a business transaction.
Do you enjoy the sort of more advisory role of that aspect of your work?
I enjoy all of it. I mean, what I enjoy is the way in which creativity unfolds, be it an artist or a collector, to result in a moment in time that is a perfect moment. So what I mean by that is that I enjoy the process of the kind of gestation of an artist's idea, when those moments come together, when they're absolutely perfect, and you just look at something in a studio and you think, this is why I do what I do, where the artist gives 1,000% to something and it just all clicks into place and they feel a sense of satisfaction and the work then goes out into the world and it brings joy and enjoyment and satisfaction to the individuals or institutions that choose to invest in it. Yeah, I think that there's a multitude of layers to that.
What's the one thing about working with a gallery or gallerist that you wish buyers understood? And perhaps it might be a simple hack that could just make their lives easier, or make their, if they're just entering or starting on the collecting journey, that could make that journey easier and simpler and perhaps less intimidating. if they are indeed intimidated.
I think that this kind of rule of thumb applies to artists and to collectors. It's every gallerist, every gallery has a certain kind of frequency and a certain kind of energy and a certain kind of ethos. And I remember at the seminar, I was saying, if it doesn't feel right, if the relationship doesn't feel right, if, you know, you feel like you're being understood or you intrinsically are trusting this person's taste or you're trusting their feedback or you're trusting their expertise, then you can surrender and trust that situation. And that could be the artist engaging with the gallery and getting immediate red flags and thinking, this is it and I have to go with this even if it's not so feel right. And the same for collectors. I think take the time to get to know people, ask people's advice, and if it feels right, if the, a multitude of kind of feelings, sensations, feedbacks, instinct feel right, then that's an easy way to commit to a journey, trusting your instinct with it.
I like that. The vibes have got to be right.
The vibes have got to be right. Exactly. Exactly.
That'll be the title of our podcast episode. The vibes got to be right.
Sounds like a t-shirt.
Emma, it does, exactly. Emma, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to ask you one final question, which tends to be a through line in many of my interviews. And that is, what do you know for sure?
I don't know if I should be very existential about this. I think
it'd be anything you want to be, your first instinct.
So my first instinct is that things can change very quickly in a matter of a day. So you could be banging, as an artist, you could be banging on doors, you could be making work, you could be trying to get out there. And the key, the secret is to keep going. Things can shift 180 degrees overnight. If we're doing our job right, we are always looking as gallerists, we are always watching. And the one thing that I know for sure is that it's literally, it can literally change for good and bad, but especially for good overnight.
I think that's beautiful. You mentioned at the top of our interview that so much of this is also about timing.
Yes, timing and consistency. If the work is good, this is also another t-shirt. If the work is good, we will find it.
Lovely. And on that inspiring note, thank you so much for your time, Emma. I really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure.
For this season of the podcast, Latitudes has teamed up with Art School Africa to bring you a series of fresh and insightful conversations. Art School Africa, a pioneering nonprofit, empowers art practitioners across the continent, like yourself, with essential business skills, mentorship, and market access opportunities. While Africa is home to a rich cultural history, access to global markets and educational resources remains limited. Art School Africa responds to these challenges by serving as a cultural engine, fueling bold, relevant, and research-driven programming, both independently and through strategic collaborations. Learn more at artschoolafrica.com or follow at Art School Africa on Instagram. Thanks for listening to the Latitudes podcast, the voice of art in Africa. Please support us by liking, subscribing, and sharing the podcast. The Latitudes podcast is hosted by myself, Refilwe Mpakanyane, for the Rare Event Foundry, and produced by DBO Media.